When you need to work quickly and confidently, you need Grammarly. It's a trusted AI writing partner that helps you get work done faster with better writing. And it works where you work, across 500,000 apps and websites. 96% of users agree Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Grammarly. Easier said. Done.
On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
We do have a very busy show coming up. My newspaper panelists are in the studio. And as always, we're going to start with taking a look across the front pages of the Sunday paper. So we'll start with the Sunday Times this morning and their lead on the front page. FAI Chief Delaney got €250,000 loan off Dennis O'Brien. This is Mark Tye and Paul Rowan writing that a business associated with John Delaney received €250,000 loan from Dennis O'Brien, then Ireland's richest man, while he was the chief executive of the FAI, and goes into details of the different accounts and the different repayments made on that on the front page. Over the other side of the top of the fold, John Mooney writing, and this is in quite a few of the papers today, Gardaí facing a review over fears of Hutch gang collusion. Gardaí are to review investigations into gangland murders and drug trafficking after fears that they were compromised by serving and retired officers who colluded with the Hutch gang. And this is, of course, after a serving detective was suspended on Friday and a retired superintendent remains in custody after being arrested on Wednesday in connection with the seizure of cannabis and cash in Dublin. Below the fold in the Sunday Times, Google searches for a cut on Dublin rates. And this is a story that Google has been appealing the rates that it pays on its rather large premises in Dublin and trying to get a reduction on that. It has secured a reduction from $360,000 a year bill for the rates down to $346,000, but is also contesting some of the payments it has to make. And then also the budget, which of course spread across the papers today. We're heading into the last week before the budget. Plenty of talk of it. Stephen O'Brien, the political editor of the Times, writing that winter fuel payout is set to get a €5 rise, so the fuel allowance to rise by €5 a week to €33 a week, very much on the cards according to some in government. But, and this is a row that we're seeing across the papers actually, there's a bit of a row as to whether that should instead go on the pension and that would benefit more people. The cost of each promise is racking up as we go across the papers. And with that in mind, we move to the Sunday Independent, which goes with the front page lead from Hugh O'Connell. Childcare burden to be eased in budget, pension and welfare hikes are on the way, cost of living is a priority for cabinet. And we of course talked on this show to Roger O'Gorman, the Minister for Children, last week, and he said that his highest priority now is actually reducing the cost of childcare, and there will be a budget package. Sunday Independent with a few more details of that, and they're also saying that there is a hike in the state pension of at least €5 thought to be on the cards, though the figure is yet to be finalised. I think, I remember reading from budget documents, it's about €175 million per calendar year a €5 rise would cost, and Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil TDs have been calling for much more than that. John McGuinness in the Dáil looking for a €20 rise, a week rise. For the pensioners, ex-Garda in Hutch link probe also makes the front page of the Sunday Independent from Ali Bracken and Maeve Sheehan. And the big picture on the front page of the Sindo, unusual actually to see two investigating Gardaí on the front page, and a special report from Maeve Sheehan into sex slavery and juju curses in provincial Ireland. That is, it's an absolutely fascinating story inside, and we'll get into it a bit later on in our newspaper panel. Moving on to the front page of the Business Post, again the budget and the NDP making the front page. Michael Brennan, the political editor of the paper, who will be joining me after 12 o'clock to talk about this in a bit more detail, saying tensions mount as government parties split over road projects in €165 billion NDP. And what you're seeing here, and again reflected across the papers, a lot of parties in government, all the parties in government, trying to claim a win in the NDP. So Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil saying that none of the previously committed to road projects are going to be scrapped and that that's a win, and the Green Party saying that they've got an extension to the government promise of spending €2 on public transport for every €1 that's spent on roads over the next 10 years. Again, same as last week, data centres make the front page of the Business Post. State to class data centres as strategic infrastructure, write Daniel Murray and Roisin Burke. Government set to press ahead with new regulations to designate data centres as strategic infrastructures. And essentially the big difference there would be that the strategic infrastructures have access to a special planning process where their plans are submitted directly to On Board Pinola rather than going through local authorities. And then below the fold in the Business Post, Varadkar seeks new tax break boost for those working at home. Taoiseach Leo Varadkar set to announce remote workers to claim up to 30% of their annual heating and electricity bills, which, given the rising bills at the moment, could be quite a good thing, in a budget tax break which could cost the Exchequer €8 million a year. But later on in the story, Michael Brennan saying the higher expenses for electricity and heating could be worth only €21 per worker on average a year, more than what's already there. So €8 million sounds like a big figure. It doesn't go very far when you spread it out. Front page of the Mail on Sunday, also talking about the NDP, metro cost spirals to €10 billion. John Lee rising that a threefold rise puts the viability of the rail line in doubt. And we know from during the week that's already been delayed, probably out to the 2030s. Moving to the Sunday World, ex-guard are linked to Hutch gangs. The story from Alan Sherry again, that former Garda is under arrest and is being investigated in relation to links and whether there was any leaks to the Hutch Gang Garda operations. And finally, the Irish Sunday Mirror on the front page. Leo doesn't give a can't say the word on air. Outspoken rock veteran Christy Dignam has taken a swipe at the tarnished Leo Varadkar, saying he doesn't give a F. The Aslan frontman rounded on him for attending a festival in the UK while we weren't allowed to have such events here. So quite a lot across the front pages. Aidan Regan and Gronin EA are joining me in studio to talk through quite a lot there, guys. I have to say good morning to you.
Hi.
Morning.
So we might start, I think, with the National Development Plan and what's going on there. Aidan, I might go to you first. What particularly stands out? Because there's a lot of kind of, oh, we're winning from different government parties and all a little bit contradictory.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably not surprising that the story is Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are trying to defend investment in road infrastructure, given that they had committed to it previously. And I think that's a particularly important issue for key rural or midland communities. So therefore, I suppose it's inevitable that Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil TDs and ministers will want to advance what their commitments were previously. I'm not sure there is as much conflict within government about this, if it is indeed the case that there will be a 2-to-1 spend, that the Green Party have got a commitment for basically €2 for every €1 being spent on roads, public transport, walking and cycle facilities. That would be a particularly important step forward. I think it's a good gain for the Green Party. But, you know, it begs a much bigger question, which is whether we should be investing into roads. And I think, you know, it's very easy to say in the abstract, no, we should be committing to net zero carbon emissions by 2050. And we have signed up to the kind of climate action bill, and that has big implications for our car dependence. But the country is dependent on the car. And many communities, particularly in rural Ireland, are very dependent on the car. So in an ideal world, I would support the Green Party's position that we should be using public transport. But we're not there yet. We're very far from it. So it doesn't surprise me that there is a type of conflict that we see in government. But I wouldn't be so sure that it's likely to leave any lasting scars on the government or anything.
One of the interesting bits, Gronia, in the papers about this is that a lot of Green Party sources seem to be saying, oh yeah, we'll have these road plans in there on paper, but they won't really happen.
I know, this is the kind of argument I wanted to see when this government first formed. This is what we all wanted, you know, but we had the pandemic to grapple with first. And there is that kind of detail that there is, you know, okay, well, the government can say in their plan, yes, we're going to approve all the roads, but in reality, that might not happen. You know, as a Green Party source told the Business Post, this is a climate focused development plan, and the government really can't ignore it. Everything is touched by climate at this stage, and commitments that they made, be it in good faith before and wanting to do well for rural communities that do need a bit of government attention, let's not forget. Even though those commitments may have been given in good faith, they have to probably revisit some of them as well to make sure that they are in line with their climate goals. And that's just the reality of the world that we're living in at the moment. There was a very good quote, though, in the Michael Brennan's front page piece, that even electric cars need roads, which I thought was funny. That illustrates for me the kind of back and forth within government about what exactly are we doing here. Okay, we're doing roads, but they're good for electric cars, but we need to keep all three parties happy, but what do people want? And obviously the road is the best example in Irish politics of how local politics and local government works as well. The potholes, the you know, how great the roads are in Kerry is always used as an example of how great the Healy Rays are at politics, you know. So it's not just a boring development political kind of high-minded debate. It actually does matter to people. And as someone who grew up in a very rural area where the nearest bus stop was still a 15, 20-minute drive away, it's a practical issue that has to be grappled with.
Mm. It is one of those things, though, Aidan, and if you look at some of the projects that are cited even in the Business Post and across some of the papers, you're looking at the N24 Limerick to Waterford. As someone who's from Waterford, that road can be particularly bad at stretches. The N4 Mullingar to Longford, the RD bypass in Louth, and of course they're launching it in Cork tomorrow, so you imagine M20 yes. is not going to get axed from this. You know, this is political capital they're playing with, even though it's a long-term plan.
Oh yeah, no, for sure. And then it's a question of trade-offs and choices within government, you know, what ought to be prioritised. As Gráinne, you're saying, that in all probability, some of those projects will be put on the long finger. And then, you know, it's about politics, as you say, within government, which ministers will prevail. And we know, and this is not some sort of criticism of Irish politics, I think it's probably reflective of, you know, local politics more generally, you know, certain voices will be heard more than others. And, you know, a lot of it will come down to a numbers game, who has more resources within the department, who has more votes, etc. So again, ideally the government would take a big picture perspective and you wouldn't have this local constituency based approach. I mean, if you want to talk about road infrastructure, like, I mean, as somebody who just cycled across Dublin city centre to get here today, I could tell you Dublin city centre could do with some serious improvement in terms of infrastructure. So we all have a stake to claim in terms of improving the infrastructure, and I think that is the big picture here. Everybody seems to agree that the public infrastructure needs serious improvement in Ireland, but then it's like, well, who gets prioritised over others? And, you know, the Greens have said that cycle and walking facilities should be their priority, unsurprisingly.
And talking about bigger picture thing, that's actually a really important point, because this is something the government has to be really good at, is the big joint up thinking bigger picture approach. Because even that, within that piece on the front of the Business Post, the fact that they want to commit to the roads, but then they have to also commit to the programme for government, the 2-to-1 spending. And then they're also looking at data centres, obviously, and the electricity used by that. All of these things kind of, and then, you know, all of these things have to tie in together for them to work. You can't just have one eye on the local politics or one eye on the development plan and ignore the rest. And they also have to grapple with the working from home aspect. That wasn't a factor when this plan was first in its kind of infancy, say. So they need to think about, people are probably going to locate more in rural areas now, and that is going to have to factor into things as well. So the bigger picture is a big kind of point for the government to look at. They have to, it's difficult for a three-party coalition, but they have to work well together to make it work across a number of aspects.
Mm. But you also have to question, particularly when we get into rural Ireland, that there has to be some sort of cost-benefit analysis to the public transport there, because obviously there's not enough people to properly fund a reliable bus or rail service, or it would already be there. So you're talking about huge subventions. And with that in mind, we can look at Metro, Aidan, and the cost across the front page of the Irish Daily Mail. Metro cost a spiral to €10 billion. That's an insane figure.
It is, and it's hard to know what's going to happen with that project, to be honest. I mean, it's been pushed out, I think, to 2034, whereas it was previously 2027. And there's always been this argument in Ireland that, oh, we need a fast-speed train network from the airport to the city. And as somebody who has travelled quite a bit within Europe, you know, that is the norm. But it's also about efficiency in terms of how quick it is to get from the airport to the city. And actually, the bus infrastructure in Dublin is not that bad in that sense. You know, you can get a bus from Dublin's airport to the city with ease. So the cost benefit analysis, who benefits from this? Clearly, there will be a big benefit to North Dublin and arguably to kind of Dublin generally. And if, depending on the design, I mean, it has changed, but it would appear that it's going to be linked up again to South Dublin, etc., and it will be linked into the kind of the expansion of the DART network. These are all very positive improvements. But then, as you say, what about the person who has to drive down from Donegal to take a plane? What about the person who has to come up from Mayo? So yeah, I mean, who benefits? What's the cost? The government will have to decide that, but it seems to me that, you know, the truth is the benefit will come to Dublin more than anybody else. Yeah,
and it does sound like it'll be great service. Every rail every 3 minutes is the
90
plan.
90 seconds,
whenever,
I think, is what they were saying then as well.
Exactly, right after that, which sounds absolutely dream stuff. Yeah. But if you don't ever build it, we don't ever get there. Gráinne, did you want to come in on that?
Just I kind of find, I understand that the, you know, other cities, capital cities, have this impressive, useful underground kind of train network. Dublin's not that big, though. You know, it's much easier to get around Dublin than most capital cities. It's one of the reasons why it's so livable as a capital city, because you can get from one end to the other. Compared, you know, our very close neighbours, London, for example, is a good example of the opposite of that. So the government has to look at that price tag and think and remember what happened with the national broadband plan and think: is this the best use of money at this moment in time, when we have so many other issues?
But you have to wonder with these 10-year plans as well, where we are going, because Dublin may eventually be that. And we're already seeing the sprawl, because no one can buy in Dublin, so you're already sprawling out. But look, we could go down a whole other road on that, and we're going to have plenty more on the...
That's a very, very important point, because, you know, if we are looking at a 10 billion expenditure and a capital investment, and you say it's one link from Dublin Airport through, what if we were to expand out the Lewis network to connect up the kind of sprawling of Dublin City and actually improve the light rail system within Dublin more broadly, connecting our city and our communities? Is that a better use of that money than connecting one out to the... Probably, right? But I don't think that's going to happen. It seems to me that the government have committed to Metro. It's going to be very hard to turn back from it. But we will be talking in a few years about how incredible the amount of money that has been spent on this. And that's before we get into the talks of inflation and construction costs, because they're likely to go up again. Mm. So that 10 billion figure is only going to go north.
I'm getting National Children's Hospital flashbacks here.
Very much. And it seems like every time we connect something like this, when it gets done, Lewis Cross City is another example, it's done 5 or 10 years too late, and then suddenly we need something else that's big and costly. But look, we'll hear plenty more on that on News Talk tomorrow. I'll be down at the National Development Plan launch, and we'll be covering it across the shows. We'll also have Michael Brennan on after 12 to talk about what he has in the Business Post, and the former Transport Minister Shane Ross will give us his view as well. Guys, lots in the papers today about the pandemic bonus. And this, again, talk about sprawling. This has become an absolute sprawl, growing you from initially what was meant to be just healthcare workers, then out to a whole bunch of other unions. Now the teachers' unions are saying, actually, we don't want it, having said that we did want it. It's a bit of a mess.
It is a bit of a mess. And it's one of those things that, you know, I felt like every day this week I was looking at another union that thinks they've done something, that they want to take part in the negotiations at the very least, if not receive the bonus. It's a tricky one, because to a certain extent, we all did something extraordinary or difficult, or, you know, went, you know, to the people who went out and worked during the pandemic when it was risky to, that is difficult. I do think healthcare workers went above and beyond, because they went into settings where a lot of the time they knew COVID was there. They knew there were COVID positive patients, and that they had to engage with those people and in very stressful environments, nurse them back to health or treat them. And particularly in those early stages where we really didn't know what we were dealing with, and the pressures under the healthcare system earlier this year, even where we didn't know if we were going to go into surge capacity, that's all very, very stressful. That is unique to the healthcare sector. But because of the way the government has handled this, and they haven't been really clear about what the pandemic bonus is for, and they kind of threw it out into the public arena to be debated on air, in the newspaper pages, you know, in the Dáil, it kind of tore a nice idea apart, and I don't see how they can claw it back. They may still give it to frontline workers, healthcare workers, and other cohorts. I'm not sure, but it feels like it's not a nice idea anymore. And someone is going, a large cohort of people are going to be unhappy, no matter what they do at this stage.
Aidan, do you have a particular view? Should it just be limited to healthcare workers? Should it now go broader? Should it be scrapped entirely?
I mean, my own personal view would be that it ought to be restricted to the most precarious frontline healthcare workers, yes, who really did put themselves on the line and really were exposed to the worst effects of this this virus and this pandemic. Very easy for me to say that, though I'm not a politician, I'm not seeking election, and I'm not having to deal with the various professional associations and trade unions that make up the kind of diverse public administrative public sector within which we live. But I agree with Grania that the fault here is that the government kind of threw it out there without any kind of clear plan, definition, what it's meant. And of course, as is inevitable, it gets picked up in the public sphere, in the media, it gets debated, it becomes salient, you have divisions, people, I want this, I want that. I don't think that was a good way to communicate and handle the issue. I would like to see the government kind of pull it back in again and just kind of bring it back to basics and say, hey, you know, for 18 months we had this really pretty serious pandemic, and a lot of our healthcare workers were working literally 24/7. We need to acknowledge the role that they played in it, and I think society in general would show solidarity with
our healthcare workers on that front, absolutely.
You know, we had student nurses working, you know, which was outside their remit of what they were meant to be doing in kind of healthcare settings. And then we had healthcare workers who couldn't get childcare, remember, and they wanted the government to provide childcare for frontline healthcare workers, and the government didn't do that in the end. And they were coming home, or they were didn't have someone to mind their children because childcare facilities were closed, and all of the, these knock-on effects, and they were coming home to maybe elderly parents they lived with and were worried about giving them COVID. So there were so many issues around the healthcare sector in particular, you know, and it was already stretched to capacity and buckling under so many different pressures. And it, that being said, there's a really good piece on the back of the Sunday Times today by Valerie Flynn about that looks at what other countries did with pandemic bonuses, which is a good, always a good contextualization for the debates we're having here. A lot of them have already been given out without this massive, well, it's seemingly the massive kind of divisive debate that we're having here. Some teacher, I think it was in Greece or in Italy, prison workers were given a bonus, and in Germany, teachers were given a bonus worth 300 to 600 euro for their work during the pandemic. That was at the very start of the crisis. In France, healthcare workers were given a grand and a half last May, but that was because of additional industrial disputes that were on at the time. But the, even that, you know, recognises even in May, they were able to say, okay, we're going to give you that. We can see now the sacrifices you're making in the middle of a health crisis, and we are going to pay you for that because this is outside the remit of your normal 9 to 5, or it's not 9 to 5 for healthcare workers, but you know.
Yeah, but you've already touched on it there. When you go into other countries, as soon as you start talking about retail staff, you start talking about Gardaí, you start talking about Defence Forces who had to do the mandatory hotel quarantine. There's a lot of people, I'm sure some of them are listening, who will feel they put their lives in risk as well for the height of this and should get some sort of reward in.
Yeah, no, for sure. And that would be a very reasonable claim, and it would be a very reasonable stake. But, you know, I still think healthcare workers, particularly the more precarious, lower paid healthcare workers that were really dealing with the front line. I mean, we have to keep in mind the purpose of our heavy restrictions in this country, why we shut things down was because capacity issues were a real problem in our healthcare system and still are. So the entire response to the crisis has been designed around mitigating and reducing pressure on a very overstretched healthcare system. And those who work within that system, it seems to me, you know, really did, you know, do a lot for our society, much more so than everybody else who also did a lot, of course. But I think, you know, we have to be, I think we just have to be a bit honest about it, that it was our healthcare workers that were most exposed to this.
Yeah, to paraphrase, everyone worked hard, but some worked harder than others, which is fairly true. Listen, that's all going to be, Michael McGrath has said, it's all going to be kicked out till after the budget at this stage to kind of save their blushes. There is a lot in the papers today, as you would expect the week before the budget, about the budget and what will be in it and won't be in it. Aidan, we might start maybe with Leo Varadkar. This is a story about Michael Brennan, who'll be joining us after 12 o'clock, actually, to tell us a bit more. But Leo Varadkar seeking new tax break boost for those working at home, but it doesn't appear to actually be much of a boost.
Yeah, no, it's a great headline, but then you get into the detail of it and it looks like it's just likely to, well, it's not entirely clear how it will work out. We'll discover next week perhaps, but it doesn't seem to be much, no. I think it works out at 20 euros a year perhaps, or something like that.
What essentially it's saying is that you could claim up to 30% of your annual heating and electricity bills back, which sounds great, especially when all the prices are going up left, right and centre if you're working from home, but that the figures estimate the higher expenses for electricity and heating bills while you're working could be worth a further 21.50 a year. So there is a certain, you can claim up to 10% at the moment, a further 21.50 per year per person,
yeah.
Which is, you know, what, 5 coffees, depending on where you buy your coffee.
I think it's more kind of politics. It looks good, I think, for Leo Varadkar, for his department, to be signalling to those who are in the top quintile, typically, of the higher income earning sectors of society, who typically work in the higher end private or public sector, who can work remotely. And therefore, you know, it's a signal that to that constituency of voters that we're thinking about you.
It goes back to this theory, though, as well, that we got into a little bit before the break, that it's 8 million euro. So it's quite a lot of money you're putting towards it that doesn't go very far once you start spreading it out, like with the pandemic bonus.
Yeah.
It's very limited.
But it's also the debate we have every time a budget comes out, which is, should you give a little to everyone and spread it around? So give, you know, the €5 or whatever it is, welfare increases bit by bit, or should you focus the money you have on more targeted sectors of society? I suppose this is a kind of, it does feel political, as you were mentioning there, because €20 per person working from home isn't all that much. And when we're talking about energy hikes, price hikes, probably isn't the best way to spend money. Although, like, I don't know if there's a way to spend 8 million that would solve the energy crisis. You know, so it's the long argued budget debate, which is, do you give everybody a little bit or do you focus it on the most vulnerable?
And that seems to particularly strike a chord this year. And the Sunday Times, I think it is, writing that there is a bit of a row as to whether to increase a fiver on the fuel allowance up to €33 a week or to actually give a €5 on the pension, which would cost about €175 million for the year, and which is going to have more impact given the rising costs.
Yeah, because they're trying to, you know, one of the things that Eamon Ryan was mentioning a couple of weeks ago was that, you know, older people won't be left out in the lurch and be facing these huge energy costs. So what group do you give that to? Do you give that to the increase in the pension and that could go towards kind of fuel costs, or do you put it into the fuel allowance as well? And that is the balance the government has to strike. I think this is one of those things that we have, or those aspects, the fuel crisis that we haven't seen make such an impact. There was always a worry in the winters gone by that there would be a kind of a crunch period with the energy crisis, but now the government has to look at it in terms of how do we spend our money so that people aren't cold this winter. It sounds quite medieval, to be honest.
Dickensian almost.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, now is the winter of our discontent. Can we get those headlines out of the way now? But I think there's a couple of interesting things that the government needs to do that are unique to this budget that will make a difference to people. One of the things is childcare. Another is the energy issue. You know, notwithstanding, I see Hugh O'Connell reporting in the Sunday Independent that a government source says the budget parameters are clear, reduce the deficit with the aim of borrowing only to invest from 2023. And that would mean modest welfare, pension increases, carbon tax increases, and a hike in the fuel allowance. That seems to sum it all up in a couple of lines of what we're going to get in the budget. The usuals and a bit of an increase in the fuel allowance.
Someone's beaten you to it with the headline. Bill Tyson writing on page 64 of the Mail, shock inflation to add to our winter of discontent. So they have started already out there. John Drennan also writing in the Mail on Sunday, should be said today, that this is going to be the fiver budget, the fiver on the pensions, the fiver on the fuel allowance. I kind of feel like it's been the fiver budget for a long time. Isn't it a little bit every year?
Yeah.
What's standing out to you, Aidan, when it comes to budget coverage?
Well, the childcare issue, I mean, it's the lead story in the Sunday Independent with Hugh O'Connell, childcare burden to be eased in budget. But when you get into the detail of it, it's not quite clear what that means. And just to pick up on a point that Grainne raised, like, if it is indeed the case that the government's plan is to reduce borrowing for consumption, day-to-day expenditure, and only to borrow for investment, let's say, that begs the question, well, what constitutes investment, right? Is it only capital physical infrastructure, like basically railways and roads and whatnot? Or does something like rebuilding your childcare infrastructure and providing a public service like childcare constitute as investment? Because in most European countries, childcare would be considered to be a key social investment in society. It enables people to access the workforce, it increases the female participation rate in the labour force, and it contributes to future human capital formation. And investing in your children is a great way to benefit future societies and so on. So what exactly is childcare? Is it a day-to-day expenditure on consumption? Because based on the article today, it would appear, yes, that it's basically about subsidies, right? We're going to subsidise people to purchase private childcare services in the market. We're going to increase the threshold for this and that. I mean, that seems to me to be a very piecemeal approach, which would see it as very much this is something we just subsidise people's incomes, which is very much an extension of the Irish type of welfare state, very focused on cash benefits. But it seems to me that the bigger picture here, which I would like to see emerging from government, particularly after this week, is what is your future plan for childcare? Mm. Is this something that you plan to deliver on a public basis? Is this a form of public infrastructure? Because it seems to me that this is going to be a growing issue amongst the electorate, amongst voters, because it is such an enormous cost.
Mm. I would say they spent a lot of their money on the Housing for All plan. You know, Darrow Green came out after that plan and he said that, you know, he was talking about the cost that he secured and biggest spend in housing in in the history of the state, and I would imagine that is the government's focus, even over healthcare. Pandemic bonuses aside, even over healthcare, that is their focus for now. Not that I'm saying you have to do one and the other, but that just seems to be their approach.
Mm. It is an interesting point you make, Aidan, because although that you can borrow to kind of fix a system like that, and particularly the health system maybe, but childcare as well, it does have a recurring cost after that, no matter what you do. And I think we had Roger Gorman on the show last week, and his officials estimate that taking fully into state ownership childcare would cost €2 billion a year recurrent.
Yeah.
So if what can you do if you were to make those capital borrowings to try and fix the system that you won't be relying on it every year?
For sure, at some stage you would have to shift it onto day-to-day revenue, because ultimately you would be talking about the expansion of the public sector and you would be considering those who provide education, early childhood learning to our children, to our toddlers, would be part of the public service in the same way our primary school teachers are. And that means you have to pay people decent salaries to get them, to get good people in, offer good conditions. This would be the norm, by the way, pretty much everywhere else in Europe. Ireland relies entirely on the private sector. I mean, it's the for-profit private sector that provides up to 90%+ of our childcare services. So yes, you're quite right in that front. But then the question will be, where would you raise the taxes? How would you expand the tax base? How would you generate the revenue? But I think, you know, for sure, those first couple of years to build that infrastructure would be important. But it seems to me that in government, and it's a kind of non-partisan issue, Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil, Labour, Sinn Féin, they all seem to want a universal publicly provided childcare system. The biggest opposition is obviously the fact that you have a deeply embedded private system in place. And what do you do to private providers? Do you effectively nationalise their service? So I think making that structural change is really the big problem. I don't see it as a cost issue. I think the government probably would be able to do it in terms of the financing of it. It's the political opposition and the kind of that would occur from the private market itself.
Grony, there's a similar argument to be made over the health service. We see a lot today. It didn't quite make the papers because the statement was quite late last night about the Sláintecare board, Stephen Donnelly making a public statement on it, saying that there's going to be a different advisory group set up after the different resignations. We were kind of all told during the pandemic, once we're out of this, we'll have a very different health service and we're ploughing money into it and we're going to keep that €4 billion. But it kind of looks like it's the same old health service.
I'm not surprised. You know, all throughout the pandemic, you talked earlier about the reason we were adhering to restrictions was because of surge or capacity within the hospitals, you know, ICU capacity, hospital capacity, how many ventilators we had. We need to limit our day-to-day interaction so that hospitals aren't overwhelmed. That's to do with a lack of capacity in our hospitals. So surely, and that's not a crisis kind of pandemic only issue. Every winter, we know there's a surge in people who get flu and people end up on hospital trolleys and corridors. We have an issue with capacity in the hospital. So even over COVID pandemic bonuses, should we not be investing in our hospital as a thank you, at the very least, to pay back people for the work that they've done? And, you know, that didn't happen. So then when the Sláintecare, I suppose it's not quite a crisis, but issues or difficulties, I suppose, came to the fore, it just spoke to a lack of attention and a lack of impetus to get what was promised done fast enough, particularly after a health crisis. I think, again, for something that has cross-party support, the political will is there. You'd imagine that there's an infrastructure there to get it into operations, you know, so it's kind of a bit disheartening to see after all of that, that things aren't really smooth sailing.
One of the other big crises the government's going to have to face in this budget is, of course, housing. And Hugh O'Connell's writing on page 3 of the Sunday Independent, Cronje. Donoghue torpedoed O'Brien's plans for tax relief for downsizers. Sinn Féin's Eoin Ó'Brien, by the way, will be joining us in the next hour to talk about this. But basically, there was efforts, and we heard about them earlier in the year, to make some sort of tax credit or an exemption from stamp duty to encourage people to downsize. And they were scotched by the Department of Finance.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. And obviously, everybody knows that, you know, whatever houses are out there, maybe if we move people around in them, then we'll be using our supply better. So basically, suggestions were made in the housing plan that said the government would assess the merits, the draft housing plan, sorry, would assess the merits and the effects of introducing a reduced stamp duty to support such purchasers who are trading down from a larger house to an apartment. And that didn't make it into the final plan. And then another line about providing right-sizing, which is another word for downsizing, incentive to enable private ownership of apartments for trading down and free up existing 3 to 4 bedroom stock. That was not agreed and also didn't end up in the final plan. There is an argument that the government is making, that Donoghue is making, that the thing that is stopping people from right-sizing or downsizing is not stamp duty, but is simply the lack of supply of apartments there for them to move into. And that's why they were, the argument is made that they were scrapped from the plan. So that is kind of the reason that the headline between Prudent Pascal not allowing Dara O'Brien's housing measure to go through around stamp duty. It's an interesting story about kind of the inner workings behind government just in the lead up to budget day. They're always the fun ones.
Aidan, we might go to you because you have your own column, obviously, in the Business Post today talking about the outcome of the German elections. We had quite a chat on the show last week preempting it, and it turned out roughly as expected, but a really fascinating coalition looks like it might be taking form.
Yeah, obviously it's not decided yet, but it looks to be highly probable that you will end up with a social democratic Green, free liberal democrat coalition, kind of a red green yellow traffic light coalition. So the dynamics will be interesting. Obviously, that would mean that the social democrats take the chancellor, the prime minister effective of Germany would be social democrat. And the big debate and negotiations, well, who's going to take finance? Who's going to take the treasury? Because that's a hugely important position within Germany. And it looks as though that's likely to go to the liberals, who, as I have mentioned in the article, would be to the right of even the Christian Democrats. So you're talking there about a party that would be more in line, I think, with, say, the British Conservatives in terms of their economic philosophies. And that's likely to kind of mitigate some of the bigger ambitions that the Green Party will have in government. So it's interesting to see how that dynamic will take place and what kind of ministry the Greens will be seeking to establish. It looks like they might create a kind of a new ministry, a supercharged economy environmental ministry. But in all probability, if that coalition is the outcome, you're going to see climate being the key priority for Germany and then also at the EU level. But it's likely to be mitigated by the preferences of the Liberals to the finance ministry.
What do you thought? Because when you end up with a coalition like that, you've already outlined the difficulties when you're trying to get any sort of big policy through, when you have those different divides. Like, coalition, as we see here, can lead to quite slow change, and which almost seems at odds with the demand for radical change, particularly when it comes to climate, a lot of people want.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting because if you look at the exit poll in Germany, those who voted Green, those who voted for the Alternative for Deutschland, and those who voted for Die Linke wanted radical change. You want to see quick radical change. And also to a certain extent the Social Democrats. But those who voted for the Conservatives, the CDU, the Union, the Bavarian Party, the CSU, the FDP, the Liberals, were happy enough to see more incremental change. And incremental change is probably more reflective of German society. So I think on the one hand, you will have this desire for big change by the Greens. But at the same time, 40% of the electorate in Germany are over the age of 60, and they vote for the Social Democrats and the CDU. And they're quite happy to see a bit more continuity and a bit more stability, which is probably why they went with Olaf Scholz as chancellor, because they're seeing a continuation, really, of Angela Merkel in him. So in that sense, you know, you're probably likely to see more continuity than change, but with climate being the key priority for the government. And in fairness to the Liberals, they have also said that they want to see that as a key priority. And this is what I think is likely to... This is why the Liberals and the Greens can kind of strike a deal together, I think, easier. They completely differ on policies, completely different political, economic philosophies, but they both want to see change in German society. And they both kind of favour innovation and the language they use and the aesthetics and the communications, they would share a lot. And they are the two parties that are most popular amongst the under 30s. Mm-hmm. So if you're under 30, under 35 in Germany, the probability is you voted Green or Liberal. If you're on the left, you voted Green. If you're on the right, you voted Liberal.
And do you see, and I know you were tweeting something about this, any sort of similarities between there and here in terms of the way particularly younger voters are going?
Yeah, I mean, yes, younger voters are choosing parties. Well, yes, in the sense of, so if you look at the 2020 election in Ireland, the under 40s voted overwhelmingly for Sinn Féin. Mm. Sinn Féin were the party of choice for every age group except for the over 60s. And I think that reflected, again, a desire for structural change, a kind of vote against the status quo, not Fianna Fáil, not Fine Gael. And you see that, I think, with the younger voters in Germany, not voting SPD or not voting CDU. So, for example, the SPD, who won the election on 25.4% of the vote, they actually lost votes amongst the under 35s. The only reason why they won the election is that they took 1.5 million votes off the CDU. And most of those votes, if not all, came from the over 60s and in particular from pensioners. So the CDU and the SPD are the parties of the older parties the status quo, and particularly for the over 60s, which are a very important constituency in Germany. Mm. So in that sense, it's similar to Ireland. I think you see younger voters just saying, look, we've seen the established parties in government for all our lives. We want to basically take a risk and take a bet on something different.
Mm. It's an interesting one, though, because often the line and the accepted political line is that particularly Fianna Fáil voters will age out and that there just won't be people. But the demographics that are actually changing in Ireland, which we see as a huge pension problem, mean there's going to be a lot more older voters in the very near future who may, well, it's hard to predict what they'll do, but that will skew the way people vote.
Yeah, and older voters vote. That's the other thing as well. The turnout is much, much higher amongst older voters. So again, you can't ignore the grey vote. And I don't mean that in any kind of derogatory way. It just means that they are a very important constituency. But with time, I do think Fianna Fáil have a big structural issue there, which is not that different to the structural issue facing the SPD, for example, which is that, you know, they can bounce back a little bit and get into the mid-20s. But ultimately, if they're losing and bleeding votes amongst younger voters, then with time, demographics and demography will dictate where the path is going.
Yeah, it's interesting to see that demographic change isn't a growing. I do feel there is a very big shift away from any party, even Sinn Féin at the next election, being dominant enough to get anywhere near a majority.
Yeah, it's the fracturing, I suppose, of politics is the other aspect. And one of the things that I noticed, just an amateur look at the German election, was that the Green Party didn't do as well as they were expecting it to. And that even though they had its most successful election in German history, they were disappointed, you know. And I think the leader, their leader might resign now to kind of make way for a kind of a new Green leadership. And they, you know, the look back and all that, and that kind of struck a chord from the February 2020, even though the Greens did really well, they thought they were going to do better. I think that comes back to a worry about Green policies leaving people behind. And to be honest, I can understand that after the way the just transition, the Bord na Mona workers are being handled. It seems to be that they shut places down and then offer training and new jobs to those workers instead of having those things in place, and that is only going to cause resentment. So I saw that as an interesting kind of thread for where you would expect young votes to go, and that they are going kind of elsewhere.
Mm. But I think with the Greens in Germany, so the reason why they didn't do as well as expected is was they didn't actually take votes off the SPD in the way they had expected. Mm. They took more votes from the CDU, the Conservatives and the FDP. So as for the centre-right bloc in German Parliament, they took more votes from the Conservatives, even though they ran on an explicitly left-wing agenda, which is about harnessing the fiscal powers of the state to invest in climate action. And I think the German electorate kind of veered towards the SPD, mainly because of Olaf Scholz. They didn't fancy Anna Baerbock as the Chancellor. And I think the idea was like, Greens, yes, but not in the Chancellor, not as Prime Minister of our country.
That was the first time they put forward a candidate for the Chancellor,
yeah.
Didn't they?
Yeah.
It's one we'll be watching with interest, because obviously the way Germany goes has a big influence on Europe. Grainne, I want to move very finally to what is a stunning piece of journalism, it has to be said, from Maeve Sheehan on page 10 of the Sunday Independent. And the headline there is, "Lured here and sold into sex slavery, juju curses, rape and threats to families, part of women's nightmare." And it's a story of four women from Nigeria who were trafficked here under a voodoo curse. And I know that will sound somewhat ridiculous to people, but when this is, you know, their religion, or when this is something they really strongly believe, and they felt that they had to do this and had to subjugate to the people who were forcing them into sex slavery, and eventually came forward to Gardaí after the king of this particular area that they're from came out and said, the king of Benin, the name of the city, came out and said that the curse was lifted. Only at that point did they feel comfortable enough to actually come forward to Gardaí and for this particular case to be broken.
Yeah, it's an incredible story. It's basically a court story. It's the first conviction under the human rights, or the human trafficking law, which was brought in 2008, and it's the first conviction under that, and that is because of how difficult it is to get a conviction. But what Maeve Sheehan does is she flips it on its head and speaks about the stories of the women who gave the testimonies in court, how they ended up in Ireland, why they went there. So two women initially, and then four and two more came over the course of the Gardaí's investigation. And it just kind of brings home how tough life is out there for people. You know, the story of one woman, they were promised a job that pays 200 euro or 2000 euro a month. In Ireland, when they got here after an arduous journey, one woman speaks about being abused in a camp in Tripoli in Libya, and the human rights abuses in those detention camps in Libya are well documented. It's why we have ships of people, migrants crossing the Mediterranean to try and get to Italy because conditions in Libya are so bad, and they're well documented. So she was in one of those camps and then eventually made her way to Ireland and to Mullingar, and two of the people prosecuted and jailed over their involvement in the trafficking of the women, you know, even they are victims of abuse. Mm. So it is a systematic issue, and one that you just assume because you feel so removed from some of the horrible things you see in the news, you forget that it goes on. And I think it's quite visceral the way Maeve Sheehan talks about this and names, you know, where these women were based and where they went to around Ireland. That just really brings it home. If you have time today, it's a page on the whole page on page 10 of the Sindo today, and it is worth your time because it just does bring home how difficult it is to people. It also highlights how hard the Gardaí work to bring this to justice. They said one of the crucial aspects was that the women came forward together and their stories corroborated one another. Then the two other women came forward during their course of the investigation, and they also, it was so detailed, their statements, and so similar that it led to the first prosecution under this law, and that's also important. They want more people to come forward if they know of a similar situation, or if they're in that situation themselves, because they say we can do something about this if you come forward and tell us your story.
Yeah, it is remarkable, and it's one of those things you kind of assume happened somewhere else, but in the evidence they gave, they listed areas including Galway, Limerick, Cork, Waterford, Cavan, Athlone, Carrick-on-Shannon, Castlebar, Dundalk, New Ross, Navan, Santry and Letterkenny. It is happening everywhere at the moment, and it is important, a break of a case, I think. Listen, that's unfortunately all that we have time for, quite a lot in the papers. My thanks to Aidan Regan, lecturer in politics at UCD and columnist with the Business Post, and Grainne Yinier from the journal.ie for joining me.